10 to 1, episode 204, Transubstantiation Book Review. Welcome to 10 to 1, where for every 10 times I spell transubstantiation, I spell it correctly once. This is going to be a book review, really more of a book narration of Transubstantiation, : Theology, History, and Christian Unity by Dr. Brett Sokold. And I'm teaching a Sunday school series on communion next month, and even longer than that, have been preparing to talk with my friend Judd, who's been on the show before, about the Eucharist, about communion. And so I thought it would be helpful for me to read this book, Transubstantiation, and kind of answer some of my questions and get a baseline of knowledge before we had that discussion. So I'm going to try to put this, 250 page book into just a very short summary. I'm going to skip over a whole bunch, let me say up front, I think Dr. Sokold did a really good job of laying out the history. He compares, we're going to go through some early church history very briefly, and then he spends a lot of time on Aquinas and how he describes transubstantiation in the Summa, and then he compares that with Martin Luther and John Calvin, and his general premise is that there was a lot of talking past each other during the Reformation, that definitions of words have changed, and some of the philosophical underpinnings had changed, and so there was a lot of misunderstandings, and not that there were no differences or that there don't continue to be differences, but that as a Roman Catholic himself, Dr. Sokold proposes transubstantiation as a via media, I guess, not a compromise position, but like a resolution between, let's say, the Reformed and the Lutheran positions. And so something that he would like to see all Christian traditions unite behind this articulation of communion. I'm not going to give too much of my own thoughts. I'll try and just give like a summary of what Dr. Sokold lays out here. But I wanted to say up front, I appreciate Dr. Sokold. I think he does a really good job of presenting his position, his church's position. And I think he's very generous towards other churches, very generous towards Luther and Calvin. And I just appreciate his tone and his ecumenical spirit. And where it's, I think, easy to do ecumenism by just ignoring differences or minimizing them, I don't think he does that. I think he tries to, clear up places where there maybe was confusion, and not say that there are more differences than there actually are. So overall, I recommend the book if you're interested in this topic. And let's jump in. So he quotes C.S. Lewis, because every theologian quotes C.S. Lewis in their book. I'm not sure how an Anglican medievalist became the central point for theological writings over the last 50 years. Not the central point, but everyone seems to like C.S. Lewis. Everybody seems to quote him. He said, the command, after all, is take, eat, not take, understand. So there is a point of this is going to be a mystery, and we're not going to understand it completely. But Dr. Sokol makes the point, it's right for faith to seek understanding, and the job of theology is to locate mysteries, not explain them away, explain them completely, but to find where the borders of mystery are. So he starts with an introduction where he covers some of everything that he's going to talk in the book. Since this is shorter, we'll just kind of go a little bit more chronologically. So he says, early church has a sacramental view of symbols, to where symbols are not pointers, they are participation. And I don't quite understand this, but I think what he's getting at is, this is something like how I've heard icons described, as it's not a picture of something to remind you of the subject, or it's not just that, but that it is participation. It's like a window to the subject. So if you have a like an icon of a saint, then the reason that like an Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic Christian would show reverence to an icon would be not that they are showing it to that symbol, but that their veneration goes through like through the window, through the portal to that saint. I think I'm getting that right. So I think that's what he's talking about, that was the view of all symbols. And I think that's super interesting. I would like to hear more about, like, what does that mean for, when people built statues of a person, how they viewed that as participatory. I don't understand that very clearly. Not going to get hung up on that, though. What he wants to say is that later on, so 1,000 years down the line, now we have more rationalistic thinkers that think of symbols as pointers. And so then you get this guy Berengarius, who says the Eucharist cannot be both bread and flesh. So it has to be symbolic. This starts a big fight, and they go back and forth for a time. I'm going to skip forward to Thomas Aquinas, who comes, and he's in a time where people are using Aristotle's framework as that's what's used in universities. That's the language, you could say, that they're thinking in. And so he takes that and modifies Aristotle's concepts to match his theology. And this is one thing that Dr. Sokol pushes back on, the common criticism of Thomas Aquinas just being beholden to Aristotle and introducing Aristotle into theology as like an interloper. And he says, there's times where Aquinas will correct Aristotle, and this is just the language that's being used at the time, so it's natural that he's going to use that. It's not he is negatively influenced or influenced by a pagan philosophy. He's just appropriating it. So what Thomas Aquinas is going to do is describe what happens in communion as the accidents of the bread and wine remain, but the substance of the bread and wine transforms into or transubstantiates into the substance of Christ's body and blood. And so what he's using substance and accidents for, accidents is like adjectives. So the things that you would describe of bread, of it being, you know, small, circular, white, salty, I guess, or the taste of it, these different adjectives. But then the substance is the noun. It's like the identity. I think I'm probably too sloppy when I think of it as like, a soul, like a body and a soul. I don't think that's quite right, but it is something about like the core of something, the identity, the isness. That's the substance. Dr. Sockold says we sense adjectives, but we apprehend nouns. So we see whiteness and we taste sweetness, but we apprehend sugar. So you don't taste the sugarness of the sugar, you taste the sweetness. Or you don't see the sugarness, but you see the whiteness. And something could change, like if you, you could change the taste of the sugar by burning it, but it would still be sugar, even though that adjective had changed, the noun stays. So that's how accidents and substance are being used by Aquinas. And so, there's a long section of Dr. Sockel going through the Summa. I think it's questions 75, 76, and 78 of Aquinas's Summa Theologica. And he just kind of breaks down the descriptions of transubstantiation in here. So I'm I don't want this to turn into an hour long thing. I don't think that's going to be helpful. You should certainly pick up the book if you want the full details, but just going through some of it. Let's see, Aquinas talks about sacraments being a sign of sacred reality that sanctifies, as being something that gives grace. You could say that sacraments give grace and God gives grace in the same way that an author and a pen wrote a sentence, or I suppose a podcaster and a microphone both recorded this podcast. He does say grace is not a quantifiable stuff. It's participation in God's life. I thought that was interesting because I had gotten that idea, I think, that the view was that grace was a like a spiritual liquid or some sort of quantifiable stuff. And I do still have questions if something like merit is still like a quantifiable stuff, or if I'm incorrect on that one too. Some of the other competing articulations of communion at this time were consubstantiation, and then like an annihilation replacement. So consubstantiation is, transubstantiation is you've got the accidents and you've got the substance, and it's the substance that's changing. It's you've got the substance of bread that is now gone, and there's just the substance of Christ. Christ being in everything. So you could say that the bread is gone and Christ remains, I think is another way I saw it explained in here. Consubstantiation would say you've got the substance of bread, and now you also have the substance of Christ coming alongside. And Aquinas is here going to say that this is a heresy. He's going to say something can't have two substances, that something can only have one substance, and that it's different from the hypostatic union, so different from Christ being fully human and fully God, having two natures, because Christ's divine nature exists on a different plane. So God doesn't exist on the same, he doesn't exist in the way that anything in the universe exists, or that the universe itself exists. He is existence. He's on a different plane of existence, is another way to say it. And so these things can coexist in the same way, like free will, human action, and God's providence are not in conflict. They exist on different planes. So he's going to say that that's how the hypostatic union works. That's how Christ can have two natures, but that communion is not like that, because Christ's substance is on the same level of the bread and the wine substance, because of the incarnation. I think I have that right, and that was one of my big questions going to this book. So I think that's his explanation for why it can't be consubstantiation. And then there is also annihilation and replacement. So the substance of the bread is annihilated. It's decreated, and then here comes Christ's substance to replace it. And Aquinas argues that God is not the cause that anything can tend toward non-existence, which is a really interesting thought. And maybe also something, there's a common discussion right now of hell versus like our souls immortal versus will souls be annihilated in hell. So yeah, an interesting thought maybe for that conversation. Aquinas is going to say Christ's body cannot change at this point. So for it to be present, something else must change into it. And my one of my questions, I wonder what the implication of that is for the second coming. Is that, what's the implication there? I'm curious how that plays in. But he says there's an eschatological aspect to this. As humans, we're becoming more like Christ. The world is being transformed. It's being transferred into Christ. And so this is happening bit by bit as we do communion and the bread and the wine becomes Christ. Then as we eat the bread, drink the wine, we are also becoming Christ. And so there's this also like eschatological goal that's part of this. Let's see. I'm just skimming over. There's a whole lot about you know, explanations for when, like, how long is Christ present? Like, if you when you eat the bread and it goes into your stomach and you digest it, is it still Christ? And so Aquinas says when the symbol is gone, so is the presence. So the accidents of the bread are the, I guess you could say, the link or the anchor. And when those are gone, then the symbol is gone. And so, you know, when the bread is digested, when it's no longer bread, or when it no longer appears to be bread, I think he would prefer to say, then it is no longer Christ either. Also is going to say it's a asymmetric relationship. So you're not chewing, when you chew the bread, when you're chewing the accidents of the bread, you're not chewing Christ's body. You're chewing the elements while Christ is present underneath. And he's also going to say that, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to articulate this one completely, but the question of does a when a mouse sneaks into the church and eats the communion bread, does the mouse eat Christ? And Aquinas, Luther, and Calvin are going to have different takes on that. But Aquinas is going to say everyone eats the body sacramentally. So if somebody goes into this mouse that goes in is going to eat the body sacramentally. The baptized Roman Catholic is going to eat the body sacramentally. A Baptist that sneaked in to a mass and illicitly took the communion, which I've not done, would also eat the body sacramentally. But only the righteous would receive the body spiritually. So there is like a two parts here of trying to explain how this is objectively Christ, but there is also why the mouse is not eating Christ. So that's how he's going to articulate it. Right. Okay. So, after Aquinas, there's going to be, a few hundred years of discussion. Duns Scotus is a big villain for a lot of folks, and where Aquinas is going to say that God exists infinitely far from creation. He is existence himself. Duns Scotus is going to say that being is univocal, that God exists in the same way creation exists. Like there's something called being that is a category that includes God and includes all of creation. And he's going to say that because his argument is you can't make an analogy between two things if there's not something in common. And what he's going to say is in common is being. And that, so he's saying that being is a category above or that contains God, where Aquinas, if I understand correctly, was saying God is being, capital B, and he is in all things, not in a pantheistic way. He is separate, but he is in all things at a different plane. So I have to admit, my head starts whirling when I start trying to understand this stuff. So I guess the result, though, of this idea of Duns Scotus is that it's going to pave the way for nominalism and then by the time we get to the Reformation, it's going to be a nominalistic version of transubstantiation is going to be the popular idea of transubstantiation. And so that's going to be what the reformers reject. So what Dr. Sokold is arguing is not that the reformers had their views of communion correct, but that what they were rejecting was not Aquinas' view. Right, and also part of this, Scotus says consubstantiation is simpler than transubstantiation because it doesn't require preserving accidents, and it's not deceitful. It's not appearing to be wine, but actually blood. Aquinas would say that it's not simpler. He would say transubstantiation isn't two miracles. So Scotus was saying transubstantiation is two miracles. It's a transformation, and it's also a preserving of accidents that are no longer attached to a substance. So you're keeping all of the adjectives of bread there, even though the noun of bread is no longer there. Aquinas says it's not two miracles, it's one miracle with an outworking. which seems like a semantic game, but okay. And he says it's not deceptive because our senses sense the sign, and then our intellects perceive the signified. Sign and signified corresponding here to accidents and substance. So I think that one makes more sense to me. And he argues, if a sign points to multiple substances, then it's a worse sign. So SCOTUS is coming. He's arguing consubstantiation makes more sense, but I'm Roman Catholic, and so I will still hold to transubstantiation. That's what Martin Luther is born into, kind of a consensus that says consubstantiation makes more sense, but Aquinas condemned it, so we're going to take transubstantiation by faith. Luther agrees with that, and it's not until he's excommunicated that he says, well, now that I've been kicked out, I'm going to reject transubstantiation because we all agree that it makes less sense. Luther's not going to call his view consubstantiation, and Lutherans don't use that term now. They're going to use the term sacramental union. Dr. Sockold points out that Luther is like a microcosm of church history in the West on communion up to his point. So he starts by saying, let's just go with the church father's view. You know, it's a mystery. It doesn't need to be explained. It's a symbol. It's also real. And so he wants to go back to that, which Dr. Sockold says, that's fine. You don't need to introduce philosophy until you have a character like Berengarius to come along in question. And now you need to explain how this fits in with reason. And so for Luther, that character is going to be Zwingli. So he has Zwingli come along. So Swiss reformer Zwingli, who questions real presence. He says, this is my body is something like I am the door. So the is something like signifies. And so so Zwingli's going to take communion symbolically, and then the ascension, and we're going to get into the ascension here in a bit. Super interesting. Communion symbolically, says Zwingli, ascension literal. Luther says, No, ascension symbolic, communion is literal, and Dr. Sockold argues that Aquinas would take both of those literally, and I hate the word literally, but that's the word we've got. So Luther then is going to, because he has to defend real presence, is going to have to reason philosophically. And he rejects, he's swimming in this sea of nominalism. That's just the normal thought right now. And he's not going to escape that influence. He rejected nominalist transubstantiation, but his articulation of real presence is closer to how the nominalists would explain it. Where Aquinas would say it's not Christ physically being present in communion, like my body is present in this room right now as I record, nor like Christ's body was present when he was born from Mary and placed in the manger. It's not that kind of physical presence. It's not definitively present, meaning the presence of something like souls or angels. Okay, so yes, earlier when I was saying like a substance being like the soul, that's not how Aquinas is going to say. It's not that kind of presence. It's a third type of presence, and that Christ is physically present in heaven. Luther is going to say Christ is definitively present, but he is going to define that differently. His omnipresence, says Luther, will make real presence possible. So when Christ ascended, so at the ascension, he is now, that doesn't mean he physically went to a location, heaven, seated at the right hand of God, is figurative and means he is now omnipresent. And again, we'll come back to that again with the ascension. That's how Luther is going to describe it. Dr. Sockold is going to say that. Let's see. Well, we'll skip over that for now. Okay. So then John Calvin he's a contemporary of Luther, but he's younger. He's coming about the same time. And he tries to reconcile Luther and Zwingli, and of course gets rejected by both. He's also going to start by saying, let's leave it as a mystery. And as everyone's having these discussions, that's not going to cut it. So now he starts to try and explain his conception of communion. And Dr. Sockold says, we don't know if Calvin read Aquinas, but his view is closer to Aquinas's. So the way Calvin is going to say that this works is that there are three categories in play. He's going to say there's the sign, so that's the bread and the wine, the signified, that's Christ's body and blood, and then the effect from both. So he's usually going to say all of Christ's benefits, or someone else might say grace is, let's also put a pin in that for the purpose of communion, the goal of communion. I guess those match up to the medieval categories of sacramentum, tantum, res et sacramentum, and res tantum. Those are going to match up to sign, signified, and the effects from both. He's going to use the terms earthly and heavenly, similarly to accidents and substance. And when he attacks physical presence, he's largely agreeing with Aquinas. So they're both, even if he didn't read Aquinas, he did read Augustine. He and Aquinas were both influenced by Augustine. And so, the sort of a kind of gross physicality that some had in over arguing against folks like Zwingli, Calvin is going to attack, and Dr. Sockold says correctly. If Luther tended to collapse the sign and the signified, so he couldn't really articulate the difference between the bread and the wine and Christ's body and blood, Dr. Sockold says Calvin tended to collapse the signified and the effect, so the Christ's body and blood and the benefits we get through taking Christ's body and blood. And he's going to say, Luther and his followers couldn't articulate enough why this wasn't cannibalism. Calvin couldn't articulate the difference between body and blood and benefits to explain that mouse situation, why a mouse would not be eating or drinking Christ. So he's going to say those are the two flaws of Luther and Calvin, or two of the flaws, and that's going to explain the difference between Luther and Calvin. And Aquinas' solution is that the bread and the wine point to Christ's body and blood. So you have a sign and signified, or like a symbol and a symbolized relationship between bread and wine and Christ's body and blood. And then also Christ's body and blood have the same relationship to the benefits of Christ. So it's like a two-tier symbol, a symbol that points to a symbol that points to Christ's benefits. Right. So just a couple more points to hit that we've already touched on, and then we'll wrap it up. With the Ascension, I found this super interesting because this is something that I don't think I'd really thought too much about growing up in church, and I've not heard or read much about the Ascension and how, like, what does it mean when we say Christ ascended into heaven? Can we say his body born of Mary is in heaven? Is heaven a location that a body could be in? What is the relationship between Christ's body born of Mary, his body in the Eucharist, and his body, which is the church? I think that's super interesting and something I'm unclear on, but appreciated reading the different explanations as like a side topic in this book. Dr. Sockold says Aquinas will say Christ is locally present in heaven, that he literally ascended to heaven. Zwingli would say Christ's body is no longer, he will say it's it's a literal ascension. Christ's body is no longer on earth. It's no longer in our space-time. It seems like Calvin is also agreeing with both of these and saying Christ's body born of Mary is ascended into heaven. It's not affected by if you pick up and move the bread and wine, you're not moving Christ's body in heaven. It seems like Aquinas and Calvin agree there. It's not like this naive physical thing that he's physically seated far, far away somewhere. A modern day, we would say in outer space somewhere. Calvin doesn't make a definitive statement on where, just says he is in heaven. I guess this would be another one of my questions. Why is this okay to explain less than communion? Because one of the the threads that Dr. Sockold is weaving here is that you have Berengarius, you have Zwingli, and now you have theologians trying to explain this. It's not something we can just leave to faith or leave and say it's a mystery. We can't explain it. We do need to explain not the mystery, but we need to explain some of the mechanism of the Eucharist. But then I guess this is one, where is heaven? Where is Christ's body? It does not need to be explained so much. So I would wonder about the difference between those, or how we decide on what's something that needs to be explained and what's not. Calvin also is saying heaven is not a place beyond the spheres. Distance is a metaphor for separation. Heaven is our destination and purpose. It's a different mode of presence for Christ. And Zwingli, Aquinas, and Calvin seem to be pretty close on the Ascension. Luther is the one that's going to say Christ is now omnipresent because going to the right hand of the Father, ascending to heaven, means everywhere. That's a figurative statement. And that's how Luther is going to explain how Christ can be ascended into heaven, but also in the really present in the elements of communion. Calvin does agree in saying that Christ is omnipresent. And how he's going to explain it is Christ is present in the Eucharist and in heaven in the same way that the sun is in the heavens and the sunlight is on earth. That's his analogy. So then Pope Benedict, and I don't know if there's a official church Catholic Church teaching on Christ being omnipresent, but at least Pope Benedict said Christ is not omnipresent, but he is in that new mode of being, maybe similar to what Calvin was saying. He's not restricted in his presence, but he's not omnipresent. So a little bit of a distinction there. And then something that it seems like everyone agreed on is that the Eucharist is not the end. Like, the point is not to eat the bread and the wine. like Zwingli would say bread and the wine. But the purpose is not to eat Christ's body and drink his blood. The purpose is something beyond that. It is a benefit that is given to us by doing that. I suppose in the same way that there are benefits to eating, but I think sometimes maybe we just eat for the pleasure of eating. So yeah, maybe that's not a good analogy. Strike that from the record. The Aquinas and the Church Fathers are going to talk about it as the benefit is church unity. And that would be what communion, that's why it's communion, right? Because it's a connection with the rest of the church through Christ. Luther usually said that the end, the purpose, the goal was the forgiveness of sins. And then Calvin would say it's all of Christ's benefits. So a little bit bigger circle there, I guess, when he was trying to explain it. Also interesting, I thought that Aquinas made the point that the Eucharist is not necessary for salvation, but the thing that it signifies is. So the unity with the mystical body of Christ is necessary for salvation, but God could bestow the effects of the sacraments without the sacraments. I think that's not a surprising idea. That would be like the early church talking about baptism by blood. I think like a martyr being killed before they could be baptized, or the thief on the cross. What's the traditional name for the thief on the cross? Dismas? Is it Saint Dismas, I think? We're talking about, I'm reviewing a Roman Catholic book, so I've got to use the traditional name. He could still be with Christ in paradise, even though he didn't take the sacraments, right? In conclusion, Dr. Sokold again is going to say, there was a lot of talking past each other during the Reformation. There has been more convergence on how to explain the Eucharist since Vatican II. as a Baptist, there's this is something I'm gonna have to, I'll have to pull on the thread of more when this changed when I'm teaching with my Sunday school class, and maybe I'll turn that into a podcast series as well. But the Baptist conception of communion did become Zwingli's take, and so you kind of have to leave Baptists and evangelicals as a whole out of this statement, but ecumenical conversations between Roman Catholics, Lutherans, Reformed, Anglicans, they're all going to agree that sacrifice, Christ's sacrifice on the cross, was a one-time event, that communion is not just remembering, it's not just a reenactment, it's also a gift of God's presence. It's a doorway to the resurrected Christ. That when the scriptures talk about memorial, that's not just remembering, nor is it repeating sacrifice, re-sacrifice. It is drawing the past into the present. So you have Cardinal Ratzinger, before he was Pope Benedict, saying that consubstantiation, or maybe we should say the Lutheran sacramental union, is compatible with transubstantiation if it's understood as the physical chemical properties of the bread remain. If that's what's meant by the bread remains, and he says that's compatible with transubstantiation. Hunsinger proposes that Protestants, because, you know, there's a lot of history with the term transubstantiation, so that makes people skittish. He proposes that Protestants would use transelementation as a term to be a different description of this process. That's the term used by the Eastern Orthodox. That's something that Rome said is an acceptable term to use. Protestants such as Bucer and Vermeely and Cramner use transelementation, and so maybe that is a way to kind of build this ecumenical bridge if it's the term transubstantiation that is the sticking point. But he points out that because there was the Reformation, because the Protestants and the Roman Catholics historically have been at odds over this topic, because there are Protestant creeds that reject transubstantiation, there is going to be more required from the Roman Catholic side, more required of Protestant churches than from Eastern Orthodox churches, because there's not been that rift. And so there maybe has to be more discussion and working out differences here in the West than between Rome and Constantinople. So there's a bunch of stuff I skipped over, but I think a 50-minute book review is probably... It's certainly more than I was planning on, and maybe more than you signed up for. Although you saw the time when you clicked play on your podcast, most likely. I'm curious. Well, I guess, I will leave it then for another podcast on sort of my thoughts past what I said at the beginning. But I'm really curious for anyone, for a Roman Catholic listener, or for anyone in any tradition, if what I was trying to explain from Dr. Sokold's book made sense. If it didn't, I'm sure that was my fault. But if there's any questions or anything to be clarified, if there's any... anything that could be stated better, or something that I said wrong, I'm certainly open to continuing the conversation. I'm anticipating a conversation with Judd, as I said at the beginning, as well as other conversations that will be started as I continue to prepare and present the Sunday school lesson series next month. So, feedback. No, wrong email address, tto@kozer.us. Please email me if you have any insight into this topic. And thanks for listening. Oh. not the intro music, the outro music. Thanks for listening. And this has been Brian Kozer with 10 to 1. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.